91.5 AM, Tufts University, Medford, Somerville, Boston. Welcome to the program. You'd like welcome to join us, of course. 855-915-9636. 855-915-9636. As I once again launch into this great excursion of live talk, right here in the heart of one of America's most liberal college campuses, here I stand, a conservative voice. And as such, I feel it's incumbent upon me, unfortunately and sadly, to discuss the events of yesterday in Westminster in London, where once again we have seen on the surface what looks like another senseless, bizarre slaughter of innocent people. Look, it's not a pleasant thing to talk about, but we have to identify it, the nature of it, in order to combat it. Otherwise, we're all going to be sitting ducks, you know? And we all are sitting ducks. You know, we all watch this stuff on television, and we look at it on the news, we look at the atrocity and the grisly nature of it. And in some cases, these killings are just, it's unspeakable. There are many of them that I can never forget. I mean, I don't think any of us will ever forget the brutal attack on September 11th of 2001. And we should note that since that date, which really will live in infamy, there has been almost 20,000 attacks by killers of the same nature. And one of the instances that I'll never forget, because it went to my soul and it pierced my mind, was that there was some live audio of the killing at the Brussels airport, which, by the way, this is the one-year anniversary of that killing. Yesterday was. And in the midst of the horrors and the mayhem and the noise of terror, I could hear one young girl, one small voice, shrieking. And we can only imagine what that was. I mean, we all have an image that comes into our mind's eye. She might have been waiting for her luggage, holding her mother's or her father's hand. She sounded like she was about maybe 5 years old, 6 years old. And when the machine guns started and when the bombs went off, and those guys threw hand grenades, she probably saw something that we can only imagine, right? There were dead bodies all over the place. Might have been her mother. Who knows? God forbid. But that one shriek is something that woke me up, woke my soul up in a way that only that could. I heard a shriek. I heard a cry. And yet, as I look at the situation, and as I prepare to write a column about it for Newsmax magazine, which carries my weekly column, I am very aware of the fact that I cannot get it published if I talk too bluntly, or even if I talk at all or name the nature of this evil, the nature of this enemy, the nature of this perversion, because there's no newspaper in America that will carry that. No mainstream paper, no mainstream media outlet. In fact, it's worse than that. We're not even allowed to think about this, what this is. I mean, these kinds of terror acts are breaking out across the planet like bedsores. They have become a part of our lives now. We all see this stuff on television. Yesterday, we saw pictures of the killings on the bridge before Parliament. And what do we say to ourselves when we see it? Let's be honest. What happens, and it's only natural, I suppose, is a little calculator goes off in our heads and we say, what are the odds that that would be me? We kind of look away and we shudder a little bit. We shrug. And we just say to ourselves, what odds are that that will be me next time? That I will be the one to buy the farm, so to speak. I mean, that's the reality. That's what's happening here. That's what we're looking at. And I can tell you that that's what's going on. I mean, it's just that simple. We, we're protecting ourselves. But the thing is that as a result, we're looking within. We're too afraid to identify the nature of this enemy. And unless we do, they're not going to let us alone. They're not going to let us just continue on. We're going to have to look behind our back every single minute. Now, I, even in this program, feel reluctant to be too explicit about what this is. So let me see if I can kind of get to it in, I suppose, somewhat of a roundabout way. I'm going to talk around it a little bit and maybe move in toward it so we could take a look. Now, these murderers, they are not the ordinary kind of murderers, like what you might expect from a mobster or a gangster or a robber, you know, or somebody who's even in a gang on a street shooting at people. Those people are murdering other people and breaking the law, and they should be executed, frankly, if they're convicted, because they have a motive. They want to kill someone for money, or they want to kill someone. You know, if you're like a spurned spouse, and so your husband or your wife is having an affair, or there's a rage, you know, you're killing someone in a crime of passion, right? We understand that. That doesn't mean that it shouldn't be punished. It should be, of course. But you know, it's a directed killing of a particular person because of a particular act. So that's not what's going on here. Nor would I argue would this be an act of war. Because in an act of war, you're killing an enemy that is killing you, and it's in a field of battle. And that this discussion, while we hope that conduct in a war is conducted with as much ethics as possible, we understand that it's not easy when you're dealing with a situation like that because it's a breakdown of order. And so there's a motive. You're defending your country, or in the case of an aggressor, you're attacking another country. You know, there's a government that has conjured up a reason for this, much of it probably untrue and stoked by passions that maybe are unnatural, but nevertheless, you've been convinced that you have to go to war for your country. And there are cases where it's a just war because your country, your homeland, your life, your property, everything is someone's attempting to steal it from you. It's like defending yourself against a robber. It's self-defense. If somebody comes in and attacks you in your home with a gun or whatever, you have a right to defend yourself, and that right can mean killing them. To stop them. You have a right. That's a moral axiom. That's not what we're talking about here either. And I suppose we could and we will look at why these killers are at war, because this is not being done for personal gain. They're not trying to get money out of us. They're at war with us, just like at 9/11. They attacked the United States by blowing up the World Trade Center and killing 3,000 people. So we have to take a look at the cause of that war and why they're at that war. But this is even worse than that. This is not a conventional war. What's going on here is worse than, you know, even Nazism. It's worse than communism. You know, the Nazis, you know, tried to hide their crime. They knew that they were doing something wrong. You know, they weren't, they knew it was a dirty business, right? They were ashamed of it. They put it behind closed doors. You know, they didn't want the public to know about it. Now, maybe it wasn't because they thought it was immoral. Maybe it was for practical reasons. But whatever the reason, they had, you know, they weren't like really doing it out in public. They would do it occasionally, but when they did, it was usually a targeted person. You know, people would just disappear. Now, I'd be the last person to be here to defend that, but I'm simply pointing out that as evil as that isn't what we're talking about here. Same thing with the communists. Every communist regime, every leftist socialist regime has been involved with the murders of millions of people, varying levels, you know, a good percentage of their population. They're doing it because they have some bizarre, demented philosophy that requires collectivization. They think that there's some virtue in making everybody equal. So they move people out of cities like they did in Phnom Penh in Cambodia, with the result that you have a forced march, you have mass starvation, you have people being shot, you've got ultimately millions of people dying, which is an incredible evil, of course. But even that, I would argue, is not as evil and is not as dangerous as what we're witnessing now. And that has been accelerating again since the attack of 9/11, 2001, when now there's been almost 20,000 of these instances around the world. The reason why what's happening now is more evil is because they are openly and proudly and brazenly slaughtering the most innocent of people. They're not targeting the military. I mean, this guy who ran a truck across the bridge, or the guy who blew up, went into a machine gun into a gay nightclub in Atlanta, they weren't hitting a military base, although they've done that too, as we know. Let's make that clear. They were just trying to kill innocent people who were conducting their lives in a free society, who are minding their own business, who are out in a nightclub, who are crossing a bridge in a downtown city, who were at a market, a Christmas market in Berlin last Christmas. Children, you know, attending a carnival in Nice, France. People in the subways of Madrid or London. There are people at a beach in I think it was Bali in Indonesia. There are people who are trying to get on with their lives, trying to live in freedom. They are specifically targeted for killing. All right? So it's deliberately not a military target, unless you define military target as they do, as anyone who lives in freedom. Anyone who is not submitted to whatever their demented philosophy is. And I'm not going to get into that yet. I'm going to be careful with that one. So you have the justification for, and indeed the adorization of, this kind of slaughter of innocent people. The nature of the killing is, you know, it's so sadistic and so evil. You know, when they have the opportunity to do that, usually they're stopped before they get there. But there's been evidence, and this has been particularly true since 9/11, that when they have the chance, they will sexually mutilate the victims, right? I mean, I don't even want to go there. Let's not even talk about how awful that is. But that's happened numerous times. The most prominent, in my opinion, example of that was the Raj Hotel in Bombay, in Mumbai, back in 2000, and I think it was 2008, 2009, and the mutilation of a Hasidic Jewish couple in their home, right? I mean, it wasn't enough to just murder them. They had to sexually mutilate and violate their dead bodies. Okay? Now, there's been reports of this amongst these same types of killers around the world. So this isn't just an isolated situation. What you have here is murderers who are involved with a level of depravity and sickness and filth that is really difficult to comprehend and definitely difficult to talk about, okay? And we see this on television and we say, okay, well, how often does that happen in the United States? I mean, well, by the way, it does happen in the United States. It's happening more. I don't think any of us need to be reminded of the murderers who attacked the Boston Marathon, right? I mean, that's something that's coming up this next Monday when these guys put a bomb, a large bomb, right at the foot of a 9-year-old boy, okay? We know what that is. We know the little Richard boy. And blew him to smithereens. I don't know if they deliberately wanted to kill that particular boy. That's who knows. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if they did. But they just felt they wanted to kill as many people as possible. We don't talk about why. We just sort of, you know, I mean, I'm going to get to this. But right now I'm just, I'm defining the nature of this. As I said, this is more evil than Nazism and communism because it's in the open and it's glorified and it's seen as good. I mean, look, there have been videos. I mean, there's one that I've seen coming out of Israel, and Israel, of course, is on the vanguard of this kind of hate. They always have been. Where they filmed this guy in a car, a suicide car filled with explosives, driving toward his victims. Now, the Israeli army filmed this because they had a tip that this was going to happen, so they were able to stop him. But they got enough of it on film that you could see his face in the window of the car. He was looking out the passenger side of the window as he started up the car to go on his suicide mission. And he had a smile on his face. This is another thing that I will never forget. Just like the young girl shrieking her scream at the airport. I wonder what happened to her. I wonder what actually happened there. But he had a smile on his face like he was about to, you know, go to his wedding. I mean, it was like a celebratory look, like he was in glory. Like this was his greatest day of his life. As he was about to blow up innocent people by riding his car into them and kill himself in the process, right? That this was somehow, you know, a great and glorious day. And we've seen how these people are celebrated. We've seen people dancing in the streets and passing out dishes of candy. We've seen how, for example, in Israel, and this is, I don't think this is particular to Israel, but after someone commits one of these atrocities, the family goes on some kind of stipend and they're financially supported for their service to their country. We've seen that. And so we have to ask ourselves, what is the nature of this enemy? Who are these killers? I mean, really, where are they coming from? What is going on here? And I would suggest that, you know, well, first of all, before I go any further, let me just give out the phone number. You're welcome to join me. This is Chuck Morse here at WMFO 91.5 AM Tufts University, Medford, Boston. 855-915-9636 is the number. 855-915-9636. And You're welcome to come on down. Let me just see if I can do a public service announcement. No?
.org makes it easy. Their simple savings plan teaches you how to start saving without going overboard. So you don't need to ditch the car and start rollerblading to work.
I look ridiculous.
You look ridiculous!
You don't need to start foraging wild berries.
I was skeptical, but these are actually pretty good.
You don't need to sell your organs on the black market.
Lie back. This is gonna hurt.
Yeah, that hurts.
You don't need to rent out your apartment to drifters.
I made a fire with the wood in your bedroom.
That's my dresser!
And your closet door.
You just need an internet connection. Don't get left behind. Start your personal savings plan with the tips and tools on feedthepig.org. That way, you don't need to sell all your belongings and live in a commune.
These dungarees belong to all of us now, Tom.
Brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.
Dear John, I was hoping it wouldn't come to this, but you've left me no choice. I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is really serious, and lately you seem to really not care. I've been there for you since day one, and I know you think I'm gonna keep ticking. But no, my friend, I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to the good times, when we were more active and ate more healthy foods, and you checked on me every once in a while? Is that too much to ask? I don't want to leave, but unless you stop ignoring me, what else am I supposed to do? Remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. Doing the minimum to control your high blood pressure isn't doing enough. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. Check, change, control. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Thank you very much, and you're welcome to join the program live. This is your host, Chuck Morse. Every Thursday, 10 a.m., right here at the heart of America's most liberal college campus, I am the lone conservative voice. 855-915-9636 is the number if you'd like to join the program. 855-915-9636. And I'm discussing the, I guess you'd say depressing for sure, but necessary topic of what happened yesterday in London. Another terrorist attack. Another Islamic extremist went ahead and rode his truck down the sidewalk on a bridge, killing as many people as possible, trying to break into the Parliament building. 4 people dead. Numerous people seriously injured. People are not going to, their mothers, their fathers, their brothers, their sister, they're not going to be coming home again because of this. So I think it is only appropriate, at least, because their blood cries out from the grave right now. Their bodies are still not cold yet. It is only appropriate that we discuss what happened, the nature of this terror, why this happened, who this person was, why they did what they did. And that is something that is not being discussed by our mainstream commentators, by our leadership, by our media. And it has to be discussed. I know, frankly, that I cannot discuss this right now in my column, which is published every week at Newsmax, because they won't publish it. So I have to write a column that's not so direct. You know, you have to kind of, you know, move around the edges a little bit and just try to see how far I can go to get something published and not get myself, you know, completely fired from there. But yet at the same time, say enough that people can understand what I'm getting at. In other words, we can't do this directly. And I may point out, by the way, that this is a major change in how we in the Western democracies do and traditionally have identified the nature of our enemies. It's a prerequisite. It is a it's the foundation of our ability to stop the enemy, to protect ourselves which in essence means that it's the moral thing to do. We have to do it, or else we're not going to survive. We have to identify their nature and contrast it with our better natures in order for us to battle them. This has been the foundation of every major victory for freedom in history. And every major loss has been because they failed to do this. I mean, look, during the Civil War, it was General Ulysses S. Grant who turned the tide and began to defeat the insurrection when he said that we will have nothing less than unconditional surrender. We're not going to negotiate with this enemy. We're not going to give them any quarter. We're demanding that they completely and totally give up, or we will annihilate them. And it was that statement that was also adopted by President Abraham Lincoln, who brought Grant in. He treated him like his son. It was the first general who actually was winning. That led to the defeat of the insurrection. During World War II, Franklin Delano Roosevelt did this. He called and he echoed Grant's statement at Casablanca Conference. In fact, Winston Churchill was quite shocked at the time that our policy was unconditional surrender of Nazism. We would not in any way countenance Nazism existing. We would fight until it was completely and utterly crushed. And that was a turning point in that war. It's more than just arms. It's more than just guns and bullets that win the day. You have to have the moral and the psychological foundation to win. And the way to do that, and that was understood by General Grant, by Franklin Roosevelt in these cases, was to identify the nature of your enemy and contrast that with your superior system and then go in and call for their complete annihilation as such. We're good. They're evil. They have to be stopped. It's that simple. Ronald Reagan did this in his famous speech a couple of months after taking office, where he referred to the Soviet Union as an evil empire. We might recall the howls of rage from the left. They were howls that make the attack now on President Trump look like a kindergarten, by the way. And yet, when he did this and made other comments as well, he contrasted the superiority of the American system to the evils of leftist communism. And that was the beginning of the end for Soviet Union. Eventually, they collapsed on their own rot without firing a shot. They completely folded on their own contradictions. They just, it became so obvious, so apparent to the Russian people that their system had failed and that the American system was superior, that they just couldn't function anymore. The whole thing just went belly up, right? I think that to a certain extent, George W. Bush did this after 9/11 when he established the Bush Doctrine that we would fight the evil enemy no matter where they were in any nation that harbors them. And that he did compare and contrast the American system with theirs. Maybe it was not a perfect contrast, but it was pretty successful. I mean, you know, all things considered. And, you know, it did separate this out. So yet we have this. The situation today, and it's a creeping situation, where now we can't do that. We cannot simply identify the nature of this enemy, say that our way of life, our system is superior, and that we're going to defeat them. We have to do it, or else these evil acts are going to continue to metastasize, and they're going to come home, you know, as Barack Obama's minister famously said, the chickens have come home to roost, right? And, you know, it's one thing to have these evil people do this. It's another thing to have Western leaders refuse to really address this problem. They won't discuss what's really going on with these people, why they are doing what they're doing, and they won't even identify who they are and what they are. I'm researching this article, so I'm not sure I'm yet in a position where I can talk about this with facts, but I think that when I talk about this now, you, my listeners here at WMFO, are going to be talking about, and you're going to see it as I do, because there's some basic truth here. Now, again, I don't have the facts. I can easily do research. I'm going to do this research later today, God willing, but I'm going to right now express this as an opinion. And that opinion is that, generally speaking, the response by our establishment liberal leaders to these terrorist attacks, both in this country and around the world, has been to blame us for the terror, not the terrorists. Now, again, this is not an explicit thing. They sometimes use wiggle words, like wiggle language around it. But this is still the language that's used. I mean, I'll just give the most recent example of this attack yesterday in England, in Britain, when the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, sounded almost like Winston Churchill, very courageously stood up and said, we are not going to be intimidated in the face of such evil and hate. But yet, she also said, we're not going to let this divide us. Who's dividing us? I mean, I'm sorry to have to say this. And again, I'm going to read it in full context. But there's something very subtle going on here that reflects a tonality, a mindset that is pervasive. And that is that somehow we are to blame. We brought this on ourselves because of why? Our divisions. You know, I mean, I heard the other day, I was listening to an interview with this very leftist radio host named Chris Hayes, who wrote a new book called The Colonies or something. And he talked about America as being very racially divided, you know, that we have all this conflict, and it's a terrible history. And yet, you know, my thoughts from listening to that are, he's looking at our society and our life as a glass half empty, not as a glass half full. What he fails to mention is that we are the most racially diverse society in history. These other societies, like in England or Europe, historically, they can be very broad-minded because they're all one race, white. Or Africa, where they're all black, in sub-Saharan Africa. Or in Asia, or anywhere else in the world where there's one race that predominates, and it's usually a single race. So, yeah, they can be very high and mighty about, racial division, because they don't have any. And we do have it, and it's imperfect, and we've had conflicts. But, I mean, all in all, we ought to look at this nation as a beacon of hope, not as this kind of, like, you know, somebody to come along, this pipsqueak, Chris Hayes, to come along and try to fan the flames of racial division. And by the way, point an accusing finger at, you know, kind of white people, or he's trying to create a race conflict, or people who have more financially, saying that we're somehow to blame for poverty and crime in a minority neighborhood. I suppose in a sense we are, or at least the left is, because of their racist policies. But America isn't. We're inclusive. This is a bunch of nonsense. And we are not to blame for Islamic terror. This is imported. This is something that is not a reflection of our values. And the fact that Islamic societies and Islamic countries are battle-strewn and poor and backward and suffering, it's not our fault. We didn't do this. They did it to themselves. And they can solve it by themselves if they choose to. Now, whether or not they choose to, or whether they decide to continue to live in these putrid societies where there's very little freedom and where women are treated like cordwood, their property, where homosexuals are thrown off the top of buildings, where infidels are killed, where a woman can't go down the walk down the street in unless she's completely covered up, or if she's in the company of a man other than her father or brother, she can be killed. You know, where they have child brides, where they have honor killings, they sexually mutilate a girl's genitals. You know, they've got polygamy, and a wife beating is allowed, and you know, divorce is only, the man can just say, "I want a divorce," three times, and they're divorced. If those are the kinds of societies that they want, and they want to have Sharia law in their societies, then I feel sad about that. I think it's a tragedy. I think it's a human rights problem, for sure. And if it gets extreme, I suppose we have to stand up and take notice in the world. But ultimately, those are their right. That's their sovereign right as a nation, just like it was the Russian people who had to get rid of the Soviet Union. It was their right to have that society. What is not their right is to import that society onto us. And by the way, before I move into that nature, that aspect of this terror, we ought to point out that leftists are quite wrong when they try to say, well, these people are underprivileged. These are among the richest societies in the world. Islamic states are vast, in many cases, oil-rich, mineral-rich nations. They occupy, in complete sovereignty, probably about 20-25% of the surface of this planet. Their nations stretch all the way from the Atlantic seaboard right into the South Pacific, as far north as Siberia, as far south as Zimbabwe. I mean, they are a vast, massive empire of nations, completely sovereign nations. So if they have economic dislocations, if they have poverty, if they have human rights abuses in their countries, that is not our fault. That is no one's fault but their own. It is up to them to overcome those societies. They're afraid of Western influence, right? You know, the Islamic doctrine, frankly, and I know I'm getting a little closer here, but, you know, it's kind of documented in many cases that they feel like the problem is Western influence, that the Western colonizers, you know, the crusaders, as it were, are corrupting their societies with our Western values. We are, you know, moving, you know, military bases in some cases, as in the case of Saudi Arabia, we have military bases, fine. And that this is to blame. Well, again, I mean, these are closed, authoritarian, communistic societies who do not want to have outside influence, and that's their right, I suppose. I would imagine and I would suggest that the best response to that is to say, okay, we won't trade with you. We won't have diplomatic relations with you unless you really need them, or we'll have minimal. You know, you can just rot on your own. You can stew in your own juices. We don't have to corrupt you. We don't have to expose you to Western values. This is why they despise Israel, by the way, at least one of the reasons. The other reason is, well, there's a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons is because Israel is a free society. It's a contradiction of their top-down, super-nanny state, authoritarian, communistic societies. Israel is relatively free and independent. People have relative equal rights there. It's not perfect, but, you know, there's no, like, you know, they don't discriminate against any one group in terms of equal rights under the law. All Israeli citizens are equal. They're all citizens. Men and women are equal. You know, I mean, homosexuals are free in Israel. You know, this is something that threatens their order. It threatens, it's one of the reasons they despise and fear Israel. But as far as the, you know, France goes, or England, which was just brutally attacked, or the United States, or Canada, if they don't like us, fine. We should pack up our bags and leave them be. No one is threatening their sovereignty. These countries have absolute sovereignty, just like we have it. They have a right to regulate foreign involvement. I mean, look, China certainly does this to an extent. They don't allow the internet. Do I think that's good? No. But that's what they do. I mean, that's their right. If they want to have a rotten, unfree society, fine. I mean, again, I feel sorry for the people, but it's up to them to change their society if they choose to. But the problem is not that they want to just have those societies. The problem is that they want to export those societies. It's not enough for them to have the Sudan. They want to have Sweden. It's not enough for them to have, you know, Syria. They want to have South Carolina. I mean, it's, you know, in other words, they don't want, they're not set to just simply, you know, stew in their own nations. They want to export their way of life. As if this is something wonderful. And that's why they attacked in London. Why else? Can you explain that? Why are they shooting people at a gay bar in Atlanta? What did the United States ever do to them? What did Atlanta do to deserve this? Right? Why are they, you know, you have a guy wielding a knife at Colorado, at a Ohio State University last October, killing people and yelling out Allah Akbar while he did it. Why is he doing that? What did the students at Ohio State University do to him? What did America do to him? Why don't we discuss this? This isn't normal. This is an act of aggression. This is an act of, to use an old-fashioned leftist word, this is an act of imperialism. They want to conquer the United States. And they want to, and the way they're going to do it is, rather than attack our military where they know they'd lose, they're going to attack our people. They're going to attack people attending the Boston Marathon. That's how they're going to do it. They're going to blow up a bomb in Times Square if they can get away with it. And ultimately, they probably, unfortunately, will. That's how they're going to do it. So they're committing, they're trying to export their way of life into countries where it's not wanted. And so we're sitting ducks while they come in and they kill us. And we have to sit there and watch our own people suffer. We have to live in fear, which is one of the reasons why Newsmax probably wouldn't let me publish an article about this because they're afraid. It's easy for me to talk. I'm afraid. They could get killed. That's what terrorism does. The whole world is afraid. Look at the Dutch candidate for prime minister, Geert Wilders. He has to have a 24-hour guard for himself and his family for the rest of his life because he criticized the Islamic killers of, was it Rembrandt or was it Van Gogh's grandson, I think it was, who was a documentary filmmaker who made a film about radical Islam. He was killed. He was stabbed in the streets. And they left a message on him. This is what's going to happen to the the enemies of jihad. There's no question who did it or why. So we're all afraid now. The whole world is afraid because that's what terrorism does. So that's one of the reasons why we're afraid to speak up and identify this enemy. We're afraid. And that's reasonable. We have a life. We have family. We want to live. You know, I mean, we've got children. I mean, we've got, wives and husbands. We have a life of meaning. We don't want to be killed. So we be quiet. We watch it and we just simply say to ourselves, oh, I hope that it's not me next time. What are the odds? Let's think, you know, boy, I mean, I guess it's not likely. It's about as likely as getting hit by a car. Yeah, maybe it is. And so unlike FDR fighting the Nazis, unlike Reagan fighting the communists, we don't say anything. We tiptoe around. But as I said, it's worse than that. We're blaming ourselves. We're eating ourselves up. We have Theresa May talking about, oh, she hopes that division doesn't, isn't affected by this. I mean, it's a worse example was Ohio Governor John Kasich, right after the stabbings at Ohio State. Oh, we may never know, he tells us, the cause of this terrible evil act. Never know, my foot will never know. The guy said Allah Akbar. I mean, what more do they need to know? What if he had marched on campus with a Nazi swastika? Right? I think we'd know then. I mean, of course we know. The fact that we would deny this, first of all, the radicals are looking at this and they think it's probably hysterical. They're like waving their hands in the air. Look, we did it. We did it. And we're pretending they didn't. But, I mean, the whole feckless approach that we're not going to identify the nature of this, we're not going to get away with it. We're not going to be free. We're not going to be able to continue to hope that it doesn't happen to us because it's going to happen eventually. It inevitably does unless you do define what this is. We have to do that. We have to identify this enemy, contrast it with our way of life, and then stop it. That doesn't mean invade Muslim countries. Not at all. I don't think we should. In fact, I think we should pull out of Muslim countries, quite frankly. I mean, since 9/11, we've been in a perpetual war. Our soldiers are fighting in, I think, 7 or 8 countries. No, I don't think that's the answer. We should get out. Let them deal with their own problems. But at the same time, we ought to strengthen ourselves and say, you're not going to come here and export your terror. You're going to have to take care of your problems in your own countries. Now, if you want our help to do that, fine. You know, we are very humane people here. We are willing to lend a hand of aid to peoples and nations that want to help themselves. You know, it's kind of like, I don't know, I guess it's sort of like welfare in a way. I mean, if we go in there and we sacrifice our own lives, or if we, let them come here, we're enabling and embedding their own, failures. Rather than say, we'll let you be self-sufficient, we'll support your freedom movements, we'll support if you want that. If you don't, fine. I don't care if Iran wants to be a mullah nation where women are, you know, beaten up if they show too much of their arm in public. I think it's sad, but the people of Iran have to make that decision. And it's that simple. We cannot, we should not interfere. You know, unless, you know, I suppose, look at, I mean, Ronald Reagan, I mean, besides making the case against the Soviet communism, he also tightened the screws on them economically, and he spoke out on Radio America, and eventually he went there, and he publicly worshipped in a church, which drove the Soviets nuts. And eventually we opened a McDonald's, which showed how ridiculous and horrible they were, since people had to wait in line for hours to get a lousy hamburger, something that any American family in this country, you know, takes for granted. You know, I mean, including people that are generally thought of as poor. I mean, in Russia, when they started, Russia likes, you know, McDonald's likes to use local produce. They wanted to make French fries. They couldn't even make good French fries because the potatoes in Russia were so lousy. They had to export them and import them from the United States. I mean, the country was falling apart, which is why they collapsed. So I would suggest that if we simply allowed them to do what they do and not interfered, they would collapse in pretty short order. We're propping them up. But as we reach toward the end of the program, I want to get into what I would contend is an even more sinister aspect of this. And by the way, you're welcome to join me, Chuck Morse, here at WMFO, 91.5 AM, Medford, Boston. 855-915-9636 is the number, 855-915-9636. And that is that the American left and the international left, at least unwittingly and subconsciously, finds common cause with the Islamic terrorists and with radical Islam. And furthermore, the international left is only one finger on a hand. It's the international liberal establishment, the globalists, that find common cause with Islam. Or I should more specifically say radical Islam. And that's because they share similar goals. They share a similar ideology. I mean, the Islamic concept of Sharia law, where in the name of some greater good, in their case, it's their God, the government acting as an agent of the God controls as many aspects of the life of the citizens as possible. There is no such thing as private ownership in a Sharia state. There is no private property. There is no rights in relationships. There's no rights in marriage for sure. Why women are property, women are inferior. You know, there's no rights. Children don't have rights. I mean, in other words, there's no freedom really to speak of. The government is involved directly as an agent of Allah in as many aspects of the life of the citizens as possible. Education, health care, welfare, culture, what they see, what they hear, what they, you know, what they read. The government has a say in it. And once in a while, the government shows its power by brutally stopping anyone who doesn't conform to that. In other words, it's totalitarian. And they share that with the left. I mean, the left has its own Sharia law. They don't call it that. It doesn't wear a hijab. It doesn't look Islamic. It isn't Islamic. Culturally, at least, you know, those things are more cosmetic than real, by the way. But when you strip it away underneath it, they are the same philosophically. The left wants to control all aspects of your life. Health, welfare, you know, education. You know, the nanny state. Rather than have like a code of Sharia law, they want to have what Steve Bannon called the administrative state, the unelected bureaucratic state, which wields legal powers of, you know, over people without representation. They can make laws or what they call directives or guidelines, they call them, that control your life. So that resonates with Islam. Jihad, it resonates with the left. What is jihad? Jihad views the world as divided between two spheres. What they call Dar el-Islam, which is the world of peace, or the world of submission. Dar el-Salam. And Dar el-Sab, which is the world of war. That is the part of the planet that has not yet submitted. And until Dar el-Salam defeats Dar el-Ab in this great dialectic, which is another leftist view, then there will be no peace. There might be temporary pieces, there might be truces, but there's no peace. Eventually, after this eternal struggle, which is commanded by their prophet, the end result is what's called Dar el-Islam, a world completely submitted. And the word Islam means to submit. This is a planet that has one world government, where it's similar to what Marx described as communism, where government fades away, as Marx said. It withers away. And in the case of the Islamic vision, it means that everyone submits to Allah. Everyone becomes a Muslim. That people who are not willing to submit, well, they're allowed to live, but they don't have the same rights. They're called dhimmis. It's like the way African Americans were treated in the Jim Crow South, right? They're second-class citizens, legally. They, you know, they're not allowed to enter certain professions. They have to wear certain kinds of clothes. Their word is not seen as valid in a courtroom if it's brought out against a Muslim. Every so often, they send a couple goon squads out to kill them all, just to keep everyone in line, like they did in Turkey. And you have this order, this internationalist order. That is similar, and that resonates with the left's vision of revolution. Revolution is just the leftist word for jihad, or the Nazi word for blitzkrieg, I'd add, and another socialist system, where, you know, the ultimate goal is to have this world of absolute equality. You know, the international beehive would become a gigantic one-world ant colony. We're like lobotomized creatures where we've given up such false ideas, as Marx called them, a false consciousness, and such bourgeois affectations as property, the right to trade freely goods and services, individual rights, love, family, loyalty, you know, fidelity, belief in a greater of the universe. I mean, all these things which Marx viewed as false consciousness or as forms of opiates of the masses, they wither away, and we have this great, wonderful international world of complete and total equality, which of course means that we're no longer human beings. Same thing with Islam, because we're no longer free. It's impossible, even if it were affected. It would be a society that would be so evil. Anyway, that wraps up the show. I'm at the end of the hour. I'm getting so involved here. I want to thank you all for listening. Chuck Morse, I shall return next Thursday, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And let's see if I can actually do something with the commercial. Here we go.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce. changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general.